The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of New Mexico.
Please be seated. We're here on Bigney v. City of Rio Rancho, S1SC 40768. Can I have appearances, please?
Good morning, Your Honor. David Westner for Petitioner City of Rio Rancho. With this morning is GQFJ Taker.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. My name is Michael Cadigan. I'm the attorney for the respondents and plaintiffs, Jessica Bigney, Wesley Bigney, Morgan Bursina, Betty Berner, and Pamela Lee Haynes, and Dr. and Mr. Bigney are in the courtroom.
Thank you. Mr. Westner, you have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, you may begin.
Well, good morning. We are before you this morning to talk about attorney fees. There are three issues I need to address, so I'll jump right in. The first issue is that Landovasso versus Sanchez, this court's 1989 ruling, should be reversed. Plaintiffs in this action sued in inverse condemnation, won a modest jury verdict, and although there is no statutory authorization for attorney fees in inverse condemnation, the district court awarded the plaintiffs their fees based on Landovasso versus Sanchez. Now, on its face, the eminent domain code only authorizes fees in condemnation actions, not in inverse condemnation actions. But the Landovasso court upheld an award of attorney fees in an inverse condemnation case.
Why do you think it only granted litigation expenses in condemnation proceedings? When I'm looking at the statute, it said, the court shall award the condemnee his litigation expenses whenever, and then it has 1, 2, 3. And in the inverse condemnation statute, it refers to the party bringing the action as the condemnee. Why can't I just read 42A125 to be referring to the condemnee in 42A129?
That's because the condemnation portion of the eminent domain code specifically defines what it means by condemnation action. There are several sections, 42A-1-17 at sec through, I believe, 20, I don't want to get my numbers wrong, but it lays out several sections.
The statute doesn't say the court shall award the condemnee in a condemnation action. It says it shall award the condemnee in his litigation expenses. It doesn't refer to the condemnation action in the initial statement.
42A-1-25 specifies three circumstances in which attorney fees are allowed. I'll quote, one, the condemnor has abandoned the condemnation proceeding. Two, the condemnation proceeding has been dismissed for any reason except settlement. Three, when there is a final determination that the condemnor does not have the right to take the property sought to be acquired in the condemnation proceeding. So they all contemplate a proceeding brought by the public body to acquire property, not a proceeding brought by a landowner or property owner after what they allege is a taking.
So is it your position that an inverse condemnation is not a condemnation proceeding?
It's not a condemnation proceeding according to the definitions in 42A-1-17 through 25, I think.
Doesn't the inverse condemnation statute live under the broader title of condemnation in the statutory structure?
It lives under the broader title of eminent domain, but according to the structure of the entire eminent domain statute, if you read the whole thing in sequence, it goes into great detail about what a condemnation proceeding is, what needs to be in the petition, who needs to be notified, how a property is valued, all these steps in a row leading up to attorney fees. Only after that whole condemnation section does it even address inverse condemnation at all. There's a statutory construction principle, I know I'll mispronounce this, but I've always said noscitur a sociis, and it is the idea of construing portions of a statute in context and in concert with portions that are around it, reading it in sequence as a harmonious whole. And if you read the eminent domain code in that fashion, start to finish, the attorney fees portion is sort of a modifier of everything that goes before it, which only talks about condemnation, not inverse condemnation. It's just another reason to understand that the legislature only intended to award attorney's fees in these three narrowly defined situations, all of which specifically refer to a condemnation proceeding as defined in the previous several sections of the statute.
So what about the policy argument that comes, at least to me, comes to mind, that if you don't have the ability to award attorney's fees in an inverse condemnation case, nobody is ever going to bring an inverse condemnation proceeding because it would be fiscally upside down to do that. And that's clearly demonstrated by the facts. In this case, you get a very small amount of money in terms of damages, and the attorney's fees are going to be, you know, a significant multiplier larger than that in any given case. And so it's just going to have this incredible chilling effect. And I don't think that's what the legislature would intend, because otherwise, why have inverse condemnation as a procedure at all?
Well, there are two points on that. For one thing, inverse condemnation does entitle the plaintiff, the landowner, to 10% interest per annum. So there is something above purely compensatory damages in the inverse condemnation portion of the code. This is not the only statutory scheme in New Mexico that doesn't allow for attorney fees. The New Mexico Tort Claims Act doesn't have a fee provision.
Let me, if you can speak for a moment on a different question on Lon Navazo, which is troubling me, which is the standard it created for the attorney's fees. He uses the term wrongfully. Prime time comes in, it seems, with respectfully, no citation, it says aggravating factors. In common law, those were the requirements of attorney's fees in condemnation actions. As I understand it, the district court judge here awarded attorney's fees because he concluded Rio Rancho didn't have the right to take the property. What guidance can you give us with regard to the standard if we were to accept the principle that attorney's fees are entitled in inverse condemnation? It seems the standard of Lon Navazo was incorrect, and prime time made it worse.
I think there are several ways to look at that, and that's because Lon Navazo is such it's a squishy sort of precedent. It doesn't define what wrongful means. It doesn't give us any guidance what the Lon Navazo concurrence would consider wrongful conduct in an alleged taking situation.
Could we rely on fraud, bad faith, and abuse of discretion that was set forth in Highway Commission versus Ruidoso?
Under the scheme of Lon Navazo, we certainly could. Really, since the Lon Navazo court didn't give us any guidance, we can approach this any number of ways under Lon Navazo. But that's the problem with Lon Navazo. It created a whole standard of wrongfulness that the primetime court interpreted as aggravated or objectionable conduct, but never told us what that is, what would meet that standard. So certainly fraud would be something I think that a large number of people would agree is wrongful.
Did the trial court explain its reasoning for awarding attorney's fees other than the order that I see, which says they didn't have a right to do it?
That's the only basis in the record that the trial court gave, the lack of a right. And, of course, that's where the Lon Navazo court divided so sharply, to decide what that part of the statute meant did not have a right to take the...
It seems to me they're confusing right with correct. There's a jury instruction in condemnation. You have a right, the eminent domain, government has a right to do it. They have to pay for it. But it seems to me there's a confusion now between right and correct. And the district court said they didn't correctly do it because the jury found an adverse conclusion. Therefore, you get your attorney's fees. Is that the right standard?
That is not the right standard. And that's the standard that the Court of Appeals had to struggle with when they addressed primetime. And in primetime, the Court of Appeals said, well, look, we're not going to award attorney's fees presumptively, as a matter of course, in all inverse condemnation actions. They've quietly reversed primetime in this case because the basis for the Court of Appeals upholding the trial court's attorney fee award was that the city of Rio Rancho, I believe the term they used, was forced the plaintiffs to bring suit. Well, that's the definition of inverse condemnation. That is what happens in every inverse condemnation. There is something that appears to have been a taking, forces someone to bring a suit. So if the Court of Appeals is now saying that anytime someone is forced to bring litigation because of a taking, they're entitled to attorney's fees, they are allowing fees presumptively and as a matter of course, which is a reversal of prime time. This is all evidence that Landovazo is extremely unworkable precedent. It hasn't been tried in the courts much. It hasn't been relied on much to speak of.
How do we know it hasn't been relied on? Yes, there's not many published cases, but below, I don't know what's happened in the trial courts. I don't know if perhaps governments are saying instead of waiting and seeing what happens when we take a property, we'll actually initiate a condemnation proceeding. I mean, how can you say that just simply based on the published cases when there could be so much more when we consider reliability?
That's true. And I can't say what's anybody's thought in their own heart of hearts. I don't know what's going on at the trial court level in published decisions. And you're correct to qualify that. It has not been, Landovazo has not certainly been heavily litigated in the courts. It's not been, there's been no reported decision under Landovazo that has awarded attorney's fees for inverse condemnation. There's been no reported decision that has relied on Landovazo as a basis to award attorney fees in an inverse condemnation action. It's just never happened.
It's never not happened.
That's true, and it hasn't come up.
That's the point. But my question is probably sophistry, I don't know, but isn't any inverse condemnation case a wrongful taking? It's where the government has taken land without bringing any action. They've taken it and not given compensation. That sounds to me like something that's wrongful. What am I missing?
What we're missing is a definition of wrongful. You have a distinct and clear idea of what wrongfulness is. I'm sure every one of us has an idea.
Could anybody conceive of an inverse condemnation as being rightful? I was right to take your land without paying you and not initiating a condemnation case.
There's a continuum, right? I mean, I think there is such a thing as an extremely wrongful taking. And there are takings such as in primetime, which was an honest mistake. Somebody put a water line in the wrong place on some blueprints. They didn't know they were doing it. It was a mistake, but it was still a taking.
But anything, so trying to deal with primetime and the senior justice's question, and it seems to me that the bright line is the difference between honest mistake and everything else. And so everything else is a wrongful taking because government does it, doesn't pay for it, and moves along. And so I can see being able to navigate the holding of primetime to say, okay, if the record supports this was a mistake, an honest mistake, we're not going to do it, but everything else, because of the what's required to prove inverse condemnation, would land in the other bucket.
I don't think there are two buckets, Your Honor. I think there is. This goes back to my point about a continuum. In this case, It was not a mistake as there was in prime time. It wasn't a situation where people didn't know where a road was and they just put the curb in the wrong place. The situation in this case was that the city saw a road with no development on it. No, the road wasn't paved. It was a paper road. It existed only on a map. And it had access from two directions. So the city, consistently with a line of cases going back to the early 60s, we're talking about the Danfelser decision, that line of cases from really when the interstates came through, that said you can impose circuity of access to a property as long as it's a reasonable degree of circuity. The jury ultimately found in this case that access from the south, from Chayote Road, was not reasonable access. But looking at the paper map and going out and looking at the situation on the ground and saying, well, there is access around the other side, that was not a wrongful decision. And the jury didn't find that it was.
But here the decision was made even contrary to the city's own engineer, who said, don't block off that road, leave it open. And the city decided to ignore that advice and go forward anyway. How is that not wrongful?
The thing the city engineer missed in that situation was drainage. Adelia Road has a slope. It slopes down toward the west, carries a lot of stormwater, and part of that drainage system is the curbing and gutter on both sides of that road. All of that water needs to be directed. It's a basic civil engineering principle that you can't just have. It's as though if you picture the curb and gutter as a pipe instead of a trough. You can't just poke a hole in that pipe and not worry about it. Epizote Road was not paved. There was no concrete apron to direct any stormwater drainage.
But isn't this line of argument isn't before us? We're here on a question of law. You didn't appeal the underlying sufficiency of the evidence or argue that there was contrary evidence to be for the appellate courts to consider. So to me that's completely out of bounds in terms of supporting your legal argument here today.
It should be out of bounds. And we're not gainsaying the jury. We're not saying the jury got it wrong.
I just want to make sure.
We accept the jury's finding that the circuity of access they believed was not reasonable. But at the time the decision was made, that we are thrust into the position of having to go outside a legal decision and instead make a moral decision, a value judgment about wrongfulness, because that is the landscape that the Landovasso Court has given us. They've imposed this wrongfulness standard that now we have to look at and think about intentions and motives and all these other things that go into these public works projects that shouldn't be part of an engineering decision. But the Landovasso Court has said, no, look at the morals of it. Look at the ethics of it. Is it wrongful?
So assume with me that the court is writing an opinion that says attorney's fees are available because this is a condemnation proceeding. What would you have us say beyond that? Because if you want to get rid of Landovasso, there's no qualifier at all for, you know, it would just be attorney's fees are available.
Attorney's fees will be available in a condemnation proceeding as defined in the eminent domain code, 42A-1-17 at SEC. If an action meets those elements, if it's brought by a public body in order to acquire property and the public body abandons it, didn't have the right to bring it in the first place, you know, those three elements, that's when attorney's fees are available. There, go ahead.
Okay, I'll let you finish answering the question, then I'll ask a question.
There may be a better way to go about this, but according to the roadmap the legislature has given us, this is the roadmap. This is where we have to look at, does an action meet the elements of a condemnation proceeding as laid out in the eminent domain code, or doesn't it?
I'm going to turn you back to, well, I'm going to ask you directly, and I'm going to respond to the same thing. In common law, you could get attorney's fees in condemnation actions, correct? Do you agree with that?
I will agree.
Will you accept that premise if you don't agree with it?
For argument, I will accept the premise.
And North, which is a court of appeals opinion, 1983 NMCA, and Rio Doso address determination that is of necessity. It's not subject to judicial review, absent fraud, bad faith, and clear abuse of discretion. I suggest that would be a proper standard for wrong. I don't know where wrongful came from. I don't know where aggravating factors came from. So to answer Justice Bacon's question, assuming we think the court concludes that attorney's fees are allowable, assuming there needs to be some standard, assuming the sovereign has the right to take property, and assuming it's really not too justiciable outside those three things, would that be an acceptable standard?
It's another sort of value judgment, isn't it? We're sort of deciding whether
or
not...
That's not a value judgment.
Well, we're talking about acceptable. And I am still saying a statutory award of attorney's fees needs to be strictly construed. There is extensive authority making that point. What Landovasso did was not strict construction. If we are going to look at who does and who does not get attorney's fees and inverse condemnation, our only guide can be what the legislature said. And I hate to keep repeating the same point over and over, but the legislature gave us three times when there are attorney's fees available in an eminent domain situation. And if it doesn't meet in one of those three elements, there are no fees available. We're not saying there couldn't be a better way to go about this. We're just saying it's not up to the courts. It has to be up to the legislature to determine who does and who does not get attorney's fees. They didn't allow fees in the Tort Claims Act, but they did in the Civil Rights Act. They make those determinations. They don't even have to say why. We just have to go by what they tell us because fee awards are strictly construed. And Landovasso didn't do that. They struggled with it because they saw conduct that offended them, that they believed was wrongful, that I think virtually anyone would agree is wrongful. A county came out, saw a piece of land, said, that's ours. You don't like it? Take us to court. That's wrongful. No one would argue that. I think we all would want to help that landowner. But there is a continuum, and we are forced to make these value judgments
but
to determine what wrongful is.
If we look at the thinking from the landowner's perspective, whether it's intentional or wrongful or with a bad heart or with a negligent heart, from the landowner's perspective, it's still wrongful. It's still a taking, and from their perspective, it's still wrongful, and they still have to bring a lawsuit to get their compensation. So what's the difference between that and the city coming in or a government entity coming in and taking property through a regular condemnation case?
Well, I think this case provides...
The landowner in both cases says it's wrongful. You're taking my land.
Well, a plaintiff in every case thinks that
Absolutely.
Something wrongful has happened. And
if they prove their case, they've proven their case.
What we should be deciding are facts. We should be deciding clearly defined elements that provide guidance to cities and municipalities. Those bodies who do have the condemnation power need to have some clear guidance of what is and what is not wrongful.
But isn't the guidance to proceed with the condemnation proceedings instead of waiting for the other side to have to file something? And wouldn't that be the kind of incentive and message from Landovasso to some degree?
The answer to that question lies on the same continuum. In Landovasso, yes, that absolutely was what should have been done. Valencia County should have brought a condemnation proceeding. They wanted to take land away from somebody. It was a bright line. It was clear whose land it was and whose it wasn't. And they said, we're taking it anyway. They should have brought a condemnation proceeding. It wasn't possible in prime time. No one knew there was a water line out of place. So no one had the information they needed. Was it wrongful? Well, wrongfulness is a matter of intent. It's a matter of mental state.
I'm saying, look at it from the landowner's perspective. It's always wrongful from their perspective.
That's true, but the fact that we're talking about what's wrongful from different perspectives is the problem. Everyone
maybe
has a different perspective.
Maybe the legislature solved that problem, going back to this chief's first question. Condemnation is condemnation is condemnation.
And condemnation is defined.
A condemnee is a condemnee.
and a condemnation proceeding is a condemnation proceeding if it meets those elements in 42A-1-17 at SEC.
And getting to her question, a condemnee under either the statutory or inverse is still a condemnee.
That's true.
As stated in the statute.
And a condemnee is one of those elements, but it's not the entire scheme of what is and is not a condemnation proceeding. The inverse condemnation proceeding or statute specifically defines itself as proceeding without instituting a condemnation action.
Let me ask you about for purposes of this question, let's assume wrongful exists. Let's just assume that. I question whether the district court even followed that. Okay, and you can clarify this for me. Paragraph 1, Rio Rancho committed inverse condemnation by taking or damaging plaintiff's property without just compensation. Okay, that was the jury determination, I assume. Paragraph 2, the city of Rancho did not have the right to take or damage plaintiff's property without compensation, and thus its actions were wrongful. It seems to me any adverse finding against the government on condemnation is going to retire attorney's fees. Because if the jury finds that there was an inverse condemnation, according to this district court judge, it's wrongful.
And that's,
so I'm not. So do you have any thoughts on those two paragraphs?
I think that's contrary to prime time. That's saying what the prime time court specifically declined to say. And that was not part of the case on appeal. Primetime went beyond the Court of Appeals, but not on that issue. That remains good law, that fees are available in inverse condemnation sometimes. When it's wrongful, when it's aggravated, when it's objectionable, and no one knows what that means. We've got public bodies throughout the state who don't have that guidance in a situation such as this. We're imposing some circuity on landowners. Is it wrongful? Not under Danfelser, it's not. It's perfectly acceptable. It's eminent domain. We have the ability to put roads. We need to have transportation for the public. Is it wrongful to make somebody go around the back way? Not under Danfelser, not under a long line of cases.
Time has expired, so if you'll wrap it up, please.
All right. Well, I haven't even started my outline, Your Honor. I think I've considered myself wrapped up and safe for rebuttal.
Mr. Cadogan.
Madam Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. This Court should affirm the unanimous decision of the New Mexico Court of Appeals in this case and the judgment of the District Court, James Knoll, for three primary reasons. First, Landavazo versus Sanchez and its progeny are well decided and provide that in cases like this one, not in all cases, but in cases like this one, where government wrongfully, intentionally takes or destroys private property.
Who found wrongful?
I'm sorry?
Did the jury find wrongful?
The jury applied the jury instruction.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I don't mean to cut you off.
I think that the jury instructions imply facts from which Judge Knoll could, under O'Neill versus USAA, the court was entitled to draw inferences from the facts necessarily found by the jury instructions.
I did not find a definition for wrongful in the jury instructions.
No. But,
and I didn't find it on the special verdict form either.
You are correct.
Did I miss anything?
You did not miss anything, okay. Justice Thompson. The inference which the court was entitled to draw is that because the land was taken or destroyed and there was no compensation, and part of the defendant's arguments, in fact, they submitted a jury instruction that said, oh, we're entitled to give you a more circuitous route to your home. They submitted jury instructions that said this is just a temporary taking, and the jury necessarily rejected those arguments.
So, why would we need the term wrongful? Because the way I read Judge Knoll's order, they didn't have, using the term right, and you can argue this point with me if you'd like, except the government has a right to take the property. That's eminent domain. They just have to pay for it.
Correct.
seems to have said it's right but incorrect because the jury found inverse condemnation. So if I take that to logical conclusion, inverse condemnation is any time the landowner prevails, they get fees. We don't need wrongful. We just need a finding.
Justice Thompson, I agree with you.
We don't need aggravating circumstances. Go ahead.
Yes. As Landovazo pointed out, there is no circumstance under which the government does not have the right to take land. Therefore, in order to give that language in the attorney's fee statute some meaning, which we must do, the legislature doesn't talk for its own health, to give it meaning, it must mean something. And the only logical thing the Landovazo court found was when they do it in a way that they do not have the right to. And what and Judge Noel...
Other than not paying for it, is there a way that they cannot do it?
Yes, and I think that prime time is a perfect example. It's wonderful.
But they didn't pay for it in prime time either.
They didn't pay for it in prime
time. So when we talk about the does not have a right to take the property in the litigation expense statute, does the does not have the right mean they took it but they didn't pay for it?
I think Landovazo teaches us that you do have to examine the underlying facts because prime time is a perfect differentiator. Prime time was really interesting. The city accidentally, because of a surveying error, put water lines on somebody else's property. And then before the lawsuit was filed, they removed them. So prime time was an example where, yes, they didn't pay him, but it was a mistake, number one. It was cured before the damage was incurred, and it was a temporary taking. So I think those are the two polar opposites. And just like Judge Ray, in her decision in this case, said, this case is more like Landovazo than prime time. Because in this case, if you look, the record is very clear in this case. Number one, the city made the affirmative choice to either purchase or give alternate access to 90 other landowners and ignored these landowners. That was at 6 transcript 214. Secondly, the city never offered my clients a penny. Number three, the city's own engineers recommended leaving the Epizote intersection open. That's at volume 6, page 211. Also, Mr. Bigney, who's in the courtroom today, he testified he actually went to the city and said, hey, I see you're going to close down my access. Please don't close down my access. And the city basically told him, go get a lawyer. I think that was his exact testimony. That was at volume 12, transcript, page 31. And the original plans that were created for this Idalia Road expansion actually showed the road remaining open. So this was an intentional, calculated decision to take this access. The city had the opportunity to even negotiate a deal or make an offer. And so under Landovazo and under the public policy of New Mexico, yes, this is an extremely wrongful situation. I wanted to also point out, because Justice Thompson raised this with the appellant, Judge Noel's decision says that he found that they took the property without just compensation, did not have the right to damage plaintiff's property, and it was wrongful. And then he refers to Landovazo versus Sanchez. So I think that the judge was imposing the rules of Landovazo versus Sanchez to support his opinion.
Without any factual findings.
Well, Your Honor, there are no facts. There are no further. Well, I think that the fact that it was wrongful and the fact that the property was taken without just compensation,
sure,
are factual. I understand wrongful is a loaded value word, but it is a fact. And it is a fact that the court has the authority and the discretion to determine.
If they would have condemned this property, offered your client an amount of money, you said, no thanks, I'm going to trial, the jury gave you more money, is it wrongful?
No, because Landovazo says to avoid wrongfulness, you should go through the eminent domain process.
That's not what Noel said. He said without compensation. They didn't get the compensation you asked. That's not what Judge... I shouldn't say Judge.
Right.
The trial court in this case did not conclude that.
Well, he found Rio Rancho committed inverse condemnation in the sentence, or I guess that would be a clause, immediately before that. So I think that is an implication that they took it without going through the process of the of the act. I also want to refer the court, you asked whether the court gave any further factual findings in regard to his reasons for the attorney's fees, and I would refer the court to volume 11 of the transcript. At the very end, you see a very long give and take between Judge Knoll and both counsel, in which I think Judge Knoll expressed a lot of opinions about why he found, number one, it was wrongful, and why he found that the fees were inextricably intertwined. And I think that would be helpful, and that is in the record. Justices, getting back to the idea, the City of Rio Rancho and Amicus City of Albuquerque are asking this court to take a rather extreme step of actually overruling a 37-year-old precedent, Landavazo versus Sanchez. And I want to make clear, the amicus brief, and to a lesser extent, the City of Rio Rancho, they're making the argument that under Landavazo, and as it has been, and its progeny, that the court must award attorney's fees in all inverse condemnation cases. That is neither the holding of Landavazo nor the holding of the Court of Appeals in this case, and that's not what we're seeking. We are seeking for Landavazo to be continued, which is under limited circumstances, where there is an uncompensated taking that is done not in accordance with the eminent domain law, and it is done intentionally, and it is not cured, then the judge may award attorney's fees. Again, I think that the appellants and the amicus are setting up a straw man. They're saying there's going to be a raid on the public fisc if judges have to give attorney's fees every time. Judges always have discretion to say no or to only give part. And this judge, who sat through 3 years of litigation, I think it was three, maybe more, and a 7 or 8 day trial, he determined in his discretion on that observation of that trial and the behavior of the parties that in this case, attorney's fees were warranted in large part because of this trial strategy of Rio Rancho, which was to intertwine its defenses with its co-defendant, Harold's Grading and Trucking.
Mr. Cadigan,
yes,
is prime time good law?
Absolutely.
Should it be overruled?
I think not. I think, and it's interesting, Judge Ray at the Court of Appeals raised a similar question.
Mr. Wesner argued in his argument today that Judge Ray, the Court of Appeals decision, quietly reversed prime time.
I
wrote that down, so I wouldn't know if you agree or disagree with that. Number one and number two, where does that take us?
I disagree because this case on its facts is consistent with both Landavazo and prime time. And Judge Ray actually asked...
Where's the mistake in this case, according to your argument?
I'm sorry?
You say that in your argument earlier to Justice Thompson, you said their actions were wrongful.
Yes.
And you refer to all kinds of evidence in the record and comments by the judge. But in prime time, it was a mistake.
Correct.
So you're saying this is both wrongful and a mistake?
No. A prime time denied attorney's fees because it was, number one, a mistake, and number two, it was cured.
Okay, I got you.
And so I think that our position is consistent with both Landavazo and prime time. And Judge Ray asked a really interesting question, which was kind of a stumper. And she said, Mr. Cadigan, isn't this a trap for government? They know that no matter what they do, if they pave a sidewalk and they make a mistake, they might have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars of attorney's fees for $5,000 worth of sidewalk. And I think the answer is no. Under prime time, it has to be intentional and it has to be not cured. And Justice
Thompson.
And
so is that language in prime time, although Court of Appeals can't modify Landavazo, but is that a more useful definition here, the intentional and uncured language? Because I tend to agree with the appellant that wrongful is in the eye of the beholder. And that's not a great way to approach the law because it doesn't provide notice and all of those related concerns. So if we're writing an opinion, would it be better to focus on the intentional and uncured language as modifying that word wrongful?
Justice Bacon, I think that's an excellent point. And I think that if the court were to not overrule Landavazo, but to clarify, it might say that wrongful means, in accordance with prime time, it must be intentional, not a mistake, and it must be uncured. And I think that would be an appropriate test. Justice Thompson suggested fraud, abuse of discretion, and one more I forget right now. And I think that, you know, that is one test, but I would urge that an intentional uncured is a better test because, especially with regard to government, I think fraud would be very difficult. It doesn't fit very well in the inverse condemnation world to use
the... So would you limit the uncured to prior to the filing of a lawsuit, or what if they cure it, you know, 2 weeks after a lawsuit's filed?
Right. I would say before the lawsuit because, Your Honor, Justice Zamora, in this case, it was interesting. The city of Rio Rancho argued this whole problem is cured because we issued Harold's Grading and Trucking a grading permit that will allow them to fix it all. It wasn't fixed at the time of trial, and it's not fixed today. So I think it probably, if there were to be a test, the cure period needs to be before the lawsuit is filed because, you know, again, my client went to the city of Rio Rancho and said, please don't shut down my access, and their response was, go get a lawyer. So that's the behavior we want to disincentivize, I think.
Assuming that they know about it.
Assuming
that, like the water line, for example, obviously they found out before the lawsuit, but there's a situation I can't think of where maybe they wouldn't.
Right.
So these would just be factors.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. If, for instance, in this case, the city did not realize that Epizote Road was left off, right, that it was on Plan A and then on Plan B it was left off, it was a big mistake, and they cured it, I would agree. There's probably not grounds for attorney's fees. But in this case, this is just as wrongful as it was in Lon de Vazo. The city of Rio Rancho had the opportunity to fix it and avoid this.
Let me ask you a question that Lon de Vazo also wrestles with, at least the dissent that wrote the opinion. And let's put on our strict interpretation of statute pad for a moment, if we could. 42A1-25A, as Rio Rancho argues, seems to provide fairly specific circumstances upon which litigation expenses, and I guess we'll assume attorney's fees are in there for the purpose of the question. Why aren't we confined to A123, which seemed to me to communicate from the legislature, you'll get your expenses if the government does not complete, they put you through this and they don't complete it. It's abandoning, it's dismissing, and there's a final determination that the condemner does not have a right to take it. Why aren't we confined by that statute?
We are confined, Your Honor, to a reasonable reading of that statute that gives meaning to each and every word in accordance with the canons of construction. And I will admit that is a very unusual set of circumstances. Having done a lot of condemnation cases, it's been dismissed once or it's not, those are rather rare. But turning to the third one, which is at issue here, again, Lon de Vazo said this. I think the Court of Appeals in this case said this. Well, if they don't, there is no circumstance under which the government does not have the right to take property. The government has incredible power.
And there's a 13702 is a jury instruction that says exactly that.
Right, absolutely.
Okay.
And so those words must mean something. And so if we say, oh, it doesn't mean, if we say there is no circumstance in which an inverse condemnation plaintiff gets attorney's fees, then we ignore that last section because there is no circumstance that either I or the Supreme Court in Lon de Vazo or its progeny can come up with where the government does not have the right to take the property. Therefore, just applying standard rules of statutory construction, we must, like Lon de Vazo did, interpret into the legislature's mind a reason for that term did not have the right and to imply the words in the way it did.
Could it be interpreted to apply more specifically to companies like PNM or a water company? Let's say PNM just decides to put a building on your property. Mm-hmm. They don't have a right to do that under eminent domain. Could that be speaking to that?
I don't think so because, I mean, to the extent that PNM's condemnation rights are equivalent to the government's condemnation rights, that would only be that would only be wrongful if they did not make some offer to buy your property before or to proceed under the Inverse Condemnation Act, and therefore it would still fall. So in other words, I think if PNM were the defendant in this case, I think the rule would be the same. If it's uncompensated, if they don't bother going through the eminent domain code, if they never offer a penny, if they knew that it was going to happen and they didn't cure it before the lawsuit was filed, I think the same rule would apply. But I do think that the Landovazo case struggled with what does this language mean. I also want to point out that there have been, I think, 36 legislatures since Landovazo was decided. At least half of those were 60-day legislatures. And no legislature, despite the Municipal League, and no legislature, to my knowledge,
an argument that the legislature doesn't read our opinions is not compelling. Well, I will tell you.
I agree, Justice Thompson, okay. But a large number of the legislators are lawyers and have some idea of what's going on. But I do think that legislative acquiescence, I think someone referred, some writer referred to legislative acquiescence as a thin reed on which to rely, but it is a reed nonetheless, Your Honor. And the legislature has reacted to problems with the common law and problems with statutes. For instance, the legislature, it was mentioned earlier today, the Civil Rights Act was enacted to deal with issues that had come up with both attorney's fees and qualified immunity. So I think we can assume that the legislature has some idea of what's going on in the courts. I wanted to turn to the issue of inextricably intertwined, which is one of the hardest words to say, inextricably intertwined. The district court did find, I want to correct something that I think is a misimpression left by both the amicus and the city. The district court and the court of appeals specifically found that in this case, the plaintiff took out of its fee application all of the matters that had to do with, specifically with Harold's Grading and Trucking. Those were all segregated out and not requested. The only thing that was left in and requested were those fees that were inextricably under Dean versus Brizuela, Chavarria, and the Hinkle case, inextricably intertwined. And we're primarily talking about the 7 days of trial. And the district court, again, in its oral ruling from the bench, in its question and answer, goes through and talks about at length how the city of Rio Rancho chose to essentially meld its defense with Harold's Grading and Trucking at trial, joining in their objections, calling the same witnesses, sharing experts. But most importantly, again, the city of Rio Rancho, in their closing argument, said the plaintiffs haven't been harmed. See, Harold's Grading and Trucking has a permit to fix all this, which they never did. And so Rio Rancho has thrown its lot in with its co-defendant, and as a result, pretty much every witness up there who said something, especially when it came to damages, had to do with both cases. And so the judge agreed that there was no way to tease out which line of the transcript went to the condemnation case, which line of the transcript went to the public nuisance case. And he said that those were inextricably intertwined. And we see in the Chavarria case, all of these inextricably intertwined cases say that if neither the judge nor the party makes any effort to show that they were inextricably intertwined, that is, they cannot be unwound, then you can't award the whole thing. But like in the Hinkle case, the court specifically found that the plaintiff's lawyer never made any effort to show that they were inextricably intertwined. Here, I think both counsel and the court parsed these attorney's fees carefully, excluded things that were not inextricably intertwined, and asked only for materials that were inextricably intertwined. Third, I want to mention public policy, and I think Justice Vigil picked up on this during the opening argument here. If the law of New Mexico is going to be the government can come in and take your land, and even if it's a small piece of land of small value, and we're not going to take care of your attorney's fees, then number one, that's just bad social policy. It encourages the government to act lawlessly under the eminent domain code, to go in the front door rather than the back door. And most importantly, the New Mexico Constitution and the U.S. Constitution, it doesn't just say you're entitled to compensation. It says you're entitled to just compensation. And if you spend $130,000 to recover $60,000 in damages, you have not justly been compensated. You are upside down, I think was the word that someone used earlier. And so the public policy, as recognized by the Landovazo case, strongly favors having attorney's fees available.
Justice, do you agree in our state that the public policy of awarding attorney's fees is pretty explicit? It's usually in statute. So if we're talking about public policy, I mean, my experience is if the legislature wants attorney's fees, they're very explicit to put it in there, given the American rule and everything else.
Absolutely, Justice Thompson, and I agree with you, that's typically what happens. This statute is denser than many, and that may be that it was written a long time ago, but again, the legislature has not changed it. But one thing Landovazo pointed out, which I thought was very interesting, Your Honor points out that at the common law, attorney's fees were awardable in a inverse condemnation case. The Landovazo court points out the model eminent domain code, which I guess is the common law as described by the ALI, provides attorney's fees. And they use that as a good reason to say that this is appropriate. The federal statutes provide for attorney's fees in inverse condemnation cases through the Relocation Act that was passed. So yes, I do think that both the common law, the Constitution of both the United States and the state of New Mexico, and the public policy strongly favor that when the government acts wrongfully, it chooses to go the back door, just taking land and sue later, rather than the front door, which is to tell somebody we're going to negotiate with you. Public policy does favor awarding attorney's fees. Again, I think that Mr. Westner addressed this a bit, but I want to talk about this idea that we need to go and try to question the jury's decision in this case. The jury decided that an inverse condemnation occurred. The jury was presented with jury instruction number 18, which made the sort of argument by Mr. Westner that this taking by closing Epizote, it was just a rerouting of traffic. It wasn't a taking. It was not. The jury rejected, necessarily rejected jury instruction 18 at 11, record proper 2776. So the idea that we need to go back and consider whether this taking was really a taking or not is simply not appropriate.
Because jury instruction means, 27 yes. said, in plaintiff's claim against Rio Rancho, none of the owner's property was taken. Why did it say
that's correct, because it was damaged. It was not taken. So in other words, you're raising an issue of taking me back several years, but my recollection of the jury instruction conference on that was we were trying to distinguish, because, you know, the Constitution says damage or take, and we wanted to make it clear to the jury, we're not saying that the city of Rio Rancho owns their property. They damaged the property. That's and Your Honor, Justice Thompson, that's my recollection of how that happened. Let's see. I also want to refer back to the cases where the attorney's fees are being decided by the court. One of the issues in the briefing here was the standard of review. And I think that the city has sort of said this is a de novo standard of review. I agree halfway. I agree that the question of whether attorney's fees are awardable in an inverse condemnation case is a de novo review, but the question of whether the actions were wrongful and whether the attorney's fees were inextricably intertwined is an abuse of discretion test. However, I do want to remind you there's a long line of cases, including the Economy Rentals versus Garcia case, which hold that especially when it comes to an attorney's fees determination, the trial judge, who in this case sat through three or however many years of litigation it was and sat through the 7 days of trial, is entitled to substantial deference in determining the facts underlying the attorney's fees. I would also point out that both the Court of Appeals, both Judge Knoll and the Court of Appeals, found that while the city of Rio Rancho, you know, they sort of, I don't want to say nitpick, but they criticized some of the hours and some of the increments of time. They never really provided evidence that the time that Judge Knoll awarded as inextricably intertwined could have been unwound. I think we met our burden of going forward to show that the time was inextricably intertwined, and the city never really came forward or developed that argument. And I think the Court of Appeals Judge Ray made that point, that they did not really support that argument. Let me just speak briefly in my 3 minutes left about stare decisis. Obviously, the city of Rio Rancho is asking for perhaps the most extreme remedy known to law, which is to overrule and abandon a 37-year-old case and make new law. You all know the tests, but let's talk about them. Clearly, the Landovazo test is workable. So, to back up, both the Padilla versus State Farm case and the Planned Parenthood versus Casey case, they said you need a compelling reason to overrule decided law. And there's simply no compelling reason here. Landovazo is workable. When you look at prime time as not a limitation, but an explanation of Landovazo, it comes up with a harmonious, good test, which perhaps this court could modify. But under the facts of this case, it would meet either Justice Thompson's suggested test, because this was an abuse of discretion, and it was not in good faith. I don't know if it was fraudulent, but it certainly wasn't in good faith to intentionally take land. And it was an abuse of discretion, including the Highway Department condemnation manual. Also, Landovazo has been relied upon. I can't remember which justice it was, said, how do we know if people have relied upon it? Well, I'll tell you one person who relied upon it, myself. And other lawyers who brought cases must have relied upon it. I can't testify to that, but it has clearly been relied upon, and there is no evidence that people have not relied upon it. It is not a remnant of an abandoned doctrine. Landovazo, Prime Time, Moongate, there's a lot of cases following Landovazo, none of them that really get to the meat of Landovazo. They kind of dance around the edges. But at least 4 cases since Landovazo have cited Landovazo as if it was good law. You know, if you look at what is a remnant of an abandoned doctrine, you know, you look at the Dred Scott case, obviously a remnant of an abandoned doctrine. This is not an abandoned doctrine. This is a doctrine that is alive and has been cited by various courts. The facts have not changed. Clearly under the Planned Parenthood versus Casey test, the Supreme Court, the prior iteration of the U.S. Supreme Court, they actually considered this question. Has reproductive health technology, has medicine changed to the point that Roe v. Wade is no longer good law? And they said, no, we recognize that sometimes a change in facts justifies a change in law, but we do not find a change in facts sufficient. Similarly, the law of eminent domain has not changed. The facts of how eminent domain is exercised has not changed, and there is no good reason to do that. This court just a few months ago decided El Paso Electric versus Public Regulation Commission, in which it held that that stare decisis is an important element of New Mexico law, and that it should only be changed in the event of compelling interests, a compelling showing. So, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, I would request that this court affirm the Court of Appeals, the unanimous Court of Appeals, affirm the trial court, and neither expand nor contract Landovazo. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wessner, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Where to start? Two things that I did not hear discussed in Mr. Cadigan's presentation. First is drainage. The question whether the city of Rio Rancho there had any alternative but to place curbing across Epizote Road at Adelia Road. There's never been any other alternative course of action proposed. As far as we're aware, there is only one way to control the drainage along that section. When a side road isn't paved, it's just raw land, it's just dirt, you have to put curb and gutter across it. It would have been wrongful to leave that break in the drainage system. Plaintiff Barcenda's land would have been a sinkhole. It would have been completely washed out when all that stormwater was directed right onto
it. Obvious that this was critical to the mission of Rio Rancho, why didn't they condemn the property? I mean, they had a path that would have avoided all of this, and they didn't. And they ignored the, you know, I think the record bears out that they ignored the pleas of the landowners, and they just said, nope, we're moving forward, hire a lawyer.
I can't say that the city engineers were looking at the Dan Felser line of authorities saying that you can impose a reasonable degree of circuity. I don't know.
So we're going to say it's okay for the city and the engineers to ignore law and their lawyers. They're going to put on blinders and just do what they want to do. I mean, that's what we would be blessing if we undo, go the way you want to, overrule Landovazo. Essentially overrule prime time, because there is no prime time without Landovazo, and say the government can do whatever it wants.
I would have to agree with you if there were no other access. If putting curb and gutter across Epizote were permanent, if there were...
But the jury's already decided there's no other access. You've lost that.
But we're talking about the intentions before the jury had made that determination. When the state of the law was Dan Felser, when you can impose a degree of circuity, no one knew that the jury was going to find that unreasonable. At the time...
That's a circular argument.
It was incorrect in hindsight.
Can I ask a... refresh my recollection. In response to Justice Thompson's question, Mr. Cadogan said that the case was tried on the basis of not taking, but damaging the property. Was this tried on the basis of inadvertent damage or on intentional damage? Or was it specified?
I think everybody was approaching it differently. And that's part of the reason Landovazo was unworkable, that we don't have any clear guidance.
No, I'm asking about what the basis for the trial.
On the part of whom, though? I think on the part of the plaintiffs, they wanted to make this look wrongful. They wanted to make a wrongfulness
sort
of
argument.
And
that evidence was admitted about Mr. Begney going to the city and saying, you're damaging my property. And he said, essentially, go get yourself a lawyer. Something that was admitted.
I don't remember where that was in the record. I don't know if that was the correct wording of it. There was testimony that Mr. Bigney approached someone at the city.
Great.
I do know that.
Thank you.
Another thing that I have not heard this morning from Mr. Cadogan is anything about strict construction, how we can be awarding attorney's fees in inverse condemnation while applying and honoring the principle of strict construction when the code just doesn't read that way. It's been suggested that the phrase does not have the right to take the land is meaningless unless, as the Landovazo court did, we graft on this in the way that they did here requirement. I don't think that that's necessary to do. I think there are plenty of times that there could be no right to take a land. I don't know that there are certain elements of government that don't have the condemnation power. I mean, if a public school decides to annex land, they don't have a right to. They don't have the condemnation power. If a city government tries to annex tribal land or build a hotel in the middle of the Rio Grande riverbed, I mean, there's land that you don't have the right to take. So I think that is as logical an interpretation as anything of what the legislature was going for.
How do we deal, this goes back, I think, back to almost the very first question. How do we deal with the fact that the legislature used the word condemnee in kind of both tranches under the eminent? Like, how do we then read all of this together? Because that's also something that we have to do. We have to look at the statute and impari materia. And I don't know, I'm struggling with what to do with the fact that they defined the parties in the same exact way for both proceedings.
There are elements that are present in inverse condemnation and in condemnation both. Condemnee is one of them. Property is one of them. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of other elements that are only present in condemnation actions and are absent in inverse condemnation actions, and that's the distinction the legislature is giving us.
Thank you, Mr. Lesner. Counsel, thank you for your arguments, for your briefing. It was very helpful. The court will take this matter under advisement. The case is deemed submitted, and you will get an opinion as soon as we are. Thank you. Court is in recess.